Chapter 25. Juan Cabrillo leaned back in the sofa with an exhausted sigh and took a sip of the brandy he'd bought from the duty-free shop at Zurich's airport. For the first time in nearly 2 weeks, he felt he could finally relax. He gazed into the fire burning in the open hearth, losing himself in the flames' hypnotic dance. When they'd dragged her off the beach, the Salandria's hull had been holed by sharp rocks. They managed to tow her 20 miles down the Kamchatka's west coast before maneuvering her into a shallow inlet and letting her sink. They transferred as much food as they could spare and emptied nearly all the supplies from the medical bay. Juan allowed Doc Huxley and her team just 24 hours to evaluate and treat as many people as she could before he ordered the Oregon to continue south. They came across the second tugboat and the dry dock Suri only 150 miles from what Eddie said the workers called Death Beach. As Cabrillo had said, she'd had a hard time making headway in the storm. They put a torpedo into the Suri as they passed her by without so much as a warning and blew the rudder off the tug's sternpost with a blast from the 40-millimeter. It was only then that Cabrillo contacted the Russian Coast Guard. He routed the radio call through a half-dozen satellite relays to mask their position and reported that there were several ships in distress in the Sea of Okhotsk and gave their GPS coordinates. He explained about the Chinese refugees, which the operator he spoke to didn't seem all that concerned about, and how there was a fortune of illegally mined gold on one of the tugs, which seemed to get more of a reaction. News of the dramatic rescue and incredible find following the worst volcanic eruption in Asia for a decade broke as the Oregon limped into Vladivostok. They turned the Russian mercenaries over to the authorities and laid up the ship for much-needed repairs. It was there that Juan phoned Langston Overholt, the principal CIA contact, and told him the whole story. He also called Hiroshi Katsui to inform him that the pirate menace that had overwhelmed the waters off Japan was over and gave instructions for their final payment. He considered the fortune in gold they'd made off with a bonus that their client didn't need to know about. 2 weeks after the eruption, Lang sent Juan an email. The first rescue workers to reach the bay reported that someone had survived the eruption aboard one of the cruise ships. He'd barricaded himself in a food locker as the pyroclastic flow buried the vessel under 5 feet of searing hot volcanic ash. Lang thought Juan would like to know the survivor gave his name as Anton Savage, a volcanologist well known in the region. Savage was currently staying at a hotel in Petropavlovsk. Juan wanted to go himself, but he felt that Eddie Seng needed it more. Franklin Lincoln went along for the ride. They were back 2 days later with the name Bernhard Volkmann. He was the banker who was going to fence Savage's gold.
"How'd you do it?" Juan had asked his two officers across the desk in his cabin.
"Simple, really," Eddie had said. "Once we broke into his room and kidnapped him, we drove him to the airport and promised that we wouldn't kill him if he told us what we wanted to know."
"And?"
"He had nothing to lose and everything to gain. So he told us."
"And?" Juan repeated, feeling like he was pulling teeth.
"Well, when the Russians rescued the Chinese off the Salandria, there weren't enough beds around Petropavlovsk to house them. So they put about 1,000 men into a hangar at the airport until they figured out what to do with them. So after Savage told me the name, I went into the hangar with him, explained to a few of the men there that Savage was responsible for what had happened to them, and, well, let nature take its course."
Juan glanced at Link.
"Like the man said, we promised not to kill him. Never said anything about turning him over to his victims. Guy had already stopped screaming by the time we were out of earshot." That is what had sent Juan back to Switzerland for a meeting with Bernhard Volkmann, which, as Juan recalled while sipping at his brandy, had gone as well as he'd expected. Volkmann had agreed to buy the 60 tons of gold that had followed Juan to Switzerland in a couple of air freight containers. He agreed to establish a trust with half the proceeds on behalf of the Chinese workers who'd mined the gold, and he agreed that he would then sell his bank and retire to the slums of Calcutta, where he would devote the rest of his life to charity. For his part,
Juan agreed not to put a bullet through the greedy bastard's head. A light knock on his door jerked Juan back to the present. The press interest in the explosion and kidnapping of Rudolf Isfording had long faded, and he looked nothing like the dark-haired, dark-eyed, and mustached Spaniard he'd pretended to be when he'd rented the safe house, so he walked calmly across the living room and swung open the door. "Hi, sailor. Remember me?" Tori wore her hair up, accenting the long line of her neck, and her blue eyes captured the glow of the fireplace and reflected it back at Juan. She wore a loose gray suit over a white Oxford shirt buttoned low enough to catch his attention. Her lips were brushed with gloss and were poised in an unsure smile. "I never expected to see you again," Juan finally stammered. She'd disappeared soon after the Oregon docked in Vladivostok without so much as a word of goodbye. Her smile faded slightly. "Are you going to invite me in?" "Sure, sure." He fixed her a drink and was careful to sit opposite her in a chair rather than next to her on the couch, facing the fire. "I didn't think you were going to see me again," she began. "But Max called me in London and dispelled some of my preconceived notions. I saw you as the rakish sea captain with your merry band of swashbucklers, and figured you would have a girl in every port. I realized that I didn't want to be another notch on your sword belt, so rather than let myself get hurt for falling for the wrong kind of man, again, I decided to go home and spare a touch of heartache. Then Max called me. He told me that you don't keep a woman in every port, and in fact, in all the years he's known you, he's never seen you even go on a date. He told me you were widowed and that your wife was killed by a drunk driver. He says you don't have a single picture of her and only told him about her one night years ago, but that since her death you've cut yourself off from relationships." Juan made to speak, but Tori silenced him by crossing to the chair and placing one delicate finger across his lips. "Max also told me that since I left, you've been an insufferable sod, which is why he called me. He seems to think you might like me, and was pretty certain I liked you. So here I am, flying in on a wing and a prayer. How about it? Remember what you told me. Only big risks can bring you big rewards. Only Max ever knew I was married. And I didn't tell him the whole truth," Juan said softly. "She was killed by a drunk driver. But what I didn't say is that she was the drunk. It was 11 years ago. She had been to rehab twice already, but it never really stuck. I didn't know she'd relapsed this time. When I saw the cops standing outside my door that night, I knew immediately what had happened. I'm sorry." Tori's hand rested on Juan's chest. "And you still carry a torch?" He stared into her eyes. "I still carry the anger." The silence stretched for several seconds. "You're not angry at her, are you?" It wasn't a question. "It's yourself you blame." "Who else can I?" "Her, for one." Tori shrugged out of her jacket. "Listen, Juan. Max told me you already have another job lined up, and I've only a week's leave from Lloyd's. I'm not asking that you drop everything and marry me. I'm not even asking that you love me. I'm asking that for once you stop taking the blame for everything bad in the world and let yourself enjoy some of the good. When was the last time you were intimate with a woman?" The frankness of the question sent a stirring jolt through his lower body, and inside him a dam he'd spent half a lifetime erecting crashed down in a swirl of emotion. His hand wrapped around the back of her head of its own volition, his fingers entwined in her hair. "Since... don't you think it's about time?" she asked, and kissed him. Juan lifted her easily from the chair, cradling her in his arms as he moved to the bedroom, his heart beating like a trip hammer. "It was never about time," he whispered in her ear. "It was just waiting for the right person. He smiled against her skin. And I have to warn you, I'm probably a bit rusty. Don't you worry. We'll work the kinks out. Tori gave a throaty chuckle. And maybe even work a few kinks in. This is Scott Brick. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Dark Watch by Clive Cussler. Text copyright 2005 by Sandecker RLLLP. Published by arrangement with G.P. Putnam Sons, a member of Penguin Audio USA, Incorporated. Production copyright 2005, Penguin Audiobooks, and Books on Tape.